Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find the club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. My name is Joe Epstein. I'm president of Sierra Steel Trading. I'm a past president of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors. And now, today's program. David Akov began his tour of duty as the Consul General of Israel for San Francisco and the entire Pacific Northwest region in August of 2004. Ironically, San Francisco is probably one of the most desired posts for diplomats abroad, even in Israel, where the Bay Area is known for its share of anti-Israel sentiment. But perhaps it is that challenge that drew David Akov to take this position. He joined the Israeli Foreign Ministry in 1985. Prior to his appointment as Consul General, David served as Director of Congressional Affairs at the Foreign Ministry in Jerusalem between 2000 and 2004. And in that capacity, he advised both the Foreign Minister's Bureau and the Prime Minister's Bureau on congressional issues relating to Israel and coordinated congressional visits to Israel. He also served as counselor for congressional affairs at the Embassy of Israel in Washington, D.C. from 1995 to 2000 as director of the Israeli Foreign Ministry's Diplomatic Training Program. Prior to that post, David served as counsel in Atlanta, Georgia from 1993 to 1995. David Akov is a native Israeli, and he served his country in the Israel Defense Forces following high school. He earned his BA in Middle East History and an MA in Political Science and Political Thought at Hebrew University in Jerusalem. He is married to Tamar, a graphic designer and an industrial engineer, and they have three children. So please give a warm Commonwealth Club welcome to the Consul General of Israel, David Akov.
Thank you very much, Joe, and what a pleasure to be here. This is really one of the, I think, greatest organizations in this great city, and what makes this great city also a very cosmopolitan one, and I know there's a lot of interest in international affairs. It was mentioned here before that one of the future programs will be Israeli cuisine at 60. I wish I could talk about that. That would have probably made my job a little easier. But unfortunately, I can't, and that's not my mandate. What I will try to do today is talk about Israel at 60, Israel on her 60th anniversary. And I know diplomats are expected mostly to speak only about politics. So I will, of course, touch politics today, probably speak mostly about politics, but not only politics, because I think when you talk about a country, and especially in, I think, an interesting and special country like Israel, on its 60th anniversary, we should touch some of the other issues. And one of the things that we have a problem with is that Israel is perceived in a kind of unilateral way, or just a one-dimensional way, because of the media, because most people get their information from the media. And they hear about Israel mostly in the context of politics or violence or conflict or some kind of friction in the Middle East. And I think what that does is it prevents the general public from seeing a more multi-layered view of Israel as a place that has many, many layers of life and many, many achievements in these last 60 years. And when you think about it, most of the people in Israel live their normal lives, everyday lives, and are not involved or even exposed directly to this conflict or this violence. And there's, you know, a very wide area of leisure, of art, of culture, and some of these things I will touch upon today. One other thing that's important to remember about Israel is that it's very small in terms of its population. It's only 7 million people, and when we view Israel's achievement in 60 years, you have to take into account that some of these achievements are very serious, especially for such a small country, and in comparison to much larger countries, sometimes that makes it, I think, even more impressive. And I don't know if there's an index that takes into account achievements per capita, general. I think that doesn't really exist, but on, I think, specific niche issues, you do that, and Israel ranks sometimes pretty much up there, and I will give a few examples. For instance, in agriculture, in the last 60 years, I think Israel is fairly known for the Jaffa oranges, but long since we've gone further than that and went to very sophisticated kind of agriculture that contributes, by the way, to a lot of other countries in the world, mostly in the in the third world, in the poor world, for instance, in developing different agricultural strains that can defend themselves against extreme temperatures or arid areas. Israel leads the way in that, and this is helping many countries in Africa and Asia, which we, the foreign ministry, sometimes are involved in that and support that. Israel started the drip irrigation system. Basically, it was invented in Israel, actually in an Israeli kibbutz, which today is one of the prime solutions for manufacturing food, mostly in arid areas and in the poorest areas of the world, again, in Africa and in Asia. The manufacturing or production of milk in Israel is per cow the highest, by far the highest in the world, and that, again, is because of research and, I guess, genetic research and agricultural research, and has to do with how these cows are raised and treated. And just the last example, which I like personally, has to do with date trees in Israel. And date trees, and date in Hebrew is tamar. Tamar is the name of my wife. But Israel has the highest, again, yield per tree of dates, even though that's kind of a, I mean, Israel has been doing it only 60 years, while other countries probably has been doing it for thousands of years. But because of agricultural technology, we managed to have the highest yield. So these are just a few examples from the agricultural field. But generally, in terms of technology, Israel per capita is the highest in the world in the number of patents that are actually used. Again, because it's a small country, but it has a very robust technological infrastructure and many, many engineers. By the way, many of them didn't study in Israel, but came from the ex-Soviet Union in the big immigration waves in the beginning of the 1990s. Israel is the third in the world per capita in the number of academic publications, and is the first in the number of young researchers in science getting grants from the European Research Council, which is a very important grant-making organization for all of Europe. So little Israel, just 7 million, is the highest as compared to 400 or 500 million in size of the whole European Union. Out of the 100 most promising startup companies in all of Europe, again, about 500 million people, 10 of them, that means 10%, are from Israel that has only 7 million people. So I guess this gives you a little bit of a feeling of our achievements, of Israel's achievements in a few of the areas, and things that you don't always you don't always hear about. And this is 60 years after Israel was formed, after a very difficult war, the War of Independence. And in 1948, there were in Israel 800,000 people. Today, as I said, 7 million. So even in terms of demography, that's been a big change. The economic base in 1948 was only agriculture and oranges, and today it's manufacturing software or computer processors. The Intel computer, which is used today in most of the laptops, was designed in the Intel Design Center in Haifa, Israel. In 1948, there were hardly roads in Israel, definitely nothing that could be called a highway. Today, there are many state-of-the-art highways. Today, we have skyscrapers that in 1948, you couldn't find even one. Or probably you couldn't find many buildings more than three floors high. And today, if you go in Tel Aviv especially, which is the big metropolis in Israel, you see dozens of buildings which are basically 40, 50, and 60 stories high. So I tried to give a little bit of kind of a feeling of what the changes were in terms of the physical appearance and economic and science. And this brings me to the core, which is politics, of where we are today in the Middle East, where Israel is, and what the prospects are for the future, and what the challenges and the threats on Israel are. Now, of course, in these 60 years, we had ups and downs. We had wars, and we had peace agreements. We had times of optimism and times of pessimism. And it's important to note that in the 60th year, even though we have great challenges, as the whole world has, especially in the Middle East, but we can look back, especially on the full part of the full half of the cup, and look especially on our two peace agreements with our two most important Arab neighbors, which are Egypt, of course, which was the first peace agreement in 1979. The Egyptian president arrived in 1977, and then the peace agreement with Jordan in 1994. Now, these two countries, one is the largest and most important Arab state, so of course that's very, very important for us. And the second, Jordan, is the country that has the longest border with Israel. So that is why our peace with Jordan is also so important. And we really cherish these two peace agreements. Of course, we hope there would be more, but these are very, very important to us, and these are two of the moderate Arab countries that we see our future with, and that we know we have more in common than we have dividing us. We have diplomatic relations with even more than these two countries, with Qatar in the Gulf and the Arab Emirates. These are not full diplomatic relations, but just interest offices, but for us, it's very, very important. The big challenges that we see today and that we try to deal with mostly are roughly three. One of them, of course, is our relations with the Palestinians and the future of those relations and where things can go. And most specifically, in terms of the immediate threat, is the situation in Gaza. The second is the issues that relate to our northern border, which is both Syria and Lebanon, and in Lebanon specifically, the Hezbollah organization with its threat over Israel and general threat. And the third issue, which I think many, many people think about and are concerned about, is actually not immediately on our border, but about 1,500 kilometers east, and that is Iran. So I will relate to all of these issues, and of course, later I would be happy to answer questions. With the Palestinians, in the last 5 to 10 years, there'd been a huge change in Israel, in the Israeli general views of the population, and of course, as a result of that, the Israeli government. And that change talked about the fact that Israel does not want to control 3 million Palestinians. That is the bottom line. And all polls suggest that most Israelis support that notion. And I think this is something very important to understand in Israel's 60th anniversary and looking back on the history of Israel and the history of the Middle East conflict. And there's a real will, which is now presented by this current government and this current coalition, to find on the other side, on the Palestinian side, a partner that can deliver on the Palestinian side an agreement between the two countries to reach a situation of a two-state solution, of two states living side by side in peace and in security for both sides. That is the formula we are looking for. And what this entails is that both sides have obligations, and our obligations is to freeze settlements, and the Palestinians' obligations is to control their territory, and more specifically, to control it in a way to stop terrorism, because that is the key. And as I said, it's reaching a goal of two states living side by side in peace and security. In order to get there, we have to get to a situation where terrorism, which is really the most troubling factor in our conflict, will be controlled, will stop. The terrorist organization will not exist and will not prosper in the Palestinian territories. And the idea is that there will be security for Israel, which is our main issue, in return to sovereignty and territory to the Palestinians. That is, I think, the idea in a nutshell. And this idea brought in 2005 the disengagement from Gaza. Former Prime Minister Sharon came to the conclusion again that Israel needs to start leaving at least part of the Palestinian territories and to start with Gaza. And Israel left completely the Gaza Strip, took all of its military forces, and dismantled all of the Israeli settlements in the Gaza Strip, which is something that was very difficult, if probably most of you remember seeing it on television. Some of the people who lived there had to be taken out by force. There were fears of real violent clashes between civilians living in these settlements and the Israeli defense forces or police. Fortunately, that did not happen. There was not violence. There was no violence, even though it was very difficult to take some of these people out of their settlements and out of the Gaza Strip. Most of these settlements were completely dismantled. And the expectations were that this will be a first step towards continuing of a process with the Palestinians and hopefully doing something similar also in the West Bank. But we were disappointed, and 3 years after, I think when you look at it in hindsight, what you see is that what this area, the Gaza Strip, developed into is pretty much a chaotic situation, chaos. There was no one who really took control on that area until about a year and a half ago, where Hamas pretty much got the upper hand and took control of that area. And today, the Gaza Strip basically is managed, ruled by Hamas, which is a terrorist organization. And it's not only recognized as a terrorist organization by Israel, but also by the United States, by the European countries. So officially, basically the civilized world treats that organization as a terrorist organization, and they rule Gaza. They're in charge of Gaza. And under their rule, we had a terrible problem of shooting Qassam rockets on many Israeli settlements in the south of Israel, mostly the town of Sderot, which is right near the city of Gaza. And what it did to the Palestinian Authority is basically just divided it into two geographic and political parts. One part in Gaza, ruled by Hamas, and the other part in the West Bank, which is governed by the Fatah faction of the Palestinians with its president, Mahmoud Abbas. Now, this threat of the rockets on Israel is something that is very problematic to us, because for the first time, we are confronted right on our borders with an area which is not ruled by a real government. It's ruled by a terrorist organization, and there's no organized bureaucracy, hierarchy, and decision-making. And this is, I think, a challenge that we are still learning how to deal with, and that is, of course, coupled with the security threat that is posed by these falling missiles on Sderot. And our dilemma is that, from one side, it's important for us, of course, that there will be quiet there and these missiles will stop falling. On the other hand, we know that if we reach some kind of a point of ceasefire, which that's where we're at now, there is a very fragile ceasefire, this allows the Hamas leadership and Hamas organization in Gaza really to arm up in a very massive way and to have missiles that can not only reach settlements that are very close to Gaza, as today, like Sderot, but much larger cities in Israel that are a little bit further away, like Ashkelon, where we have a major power plant and desalinization plant, and even further than that, Ashdod, which is a major city, and maybe even if they can get much bigger missiles, which we're afraid they can even reach Tel Aviv. So this is really our dilemma of when you confront a terrorist organization, if you give them a lull, a quiet period, they can really increase their capacity of destruction in terms of getting new missiles. And that's where we are today. We are in this kind of a very fragile ceasefire agreement brokered by the Egyptians. And it is working more or less in the last few weeks. But we really don't know how long this will hold. And the problem is that there are very many extreme factions in Gaza, whether related to Hamas or to Islamic Jihad, who, of course, are controlled by no one and are just doing whatever they want. And the fear is that they will just start shooting missile again, and that can really jeopardize the whole ceasefire agreement. Now, I can see three scenarios of what can happen in Gaza for beyond this ceasefire. The first scenario is political. Our position is that we do not want to deal with Hamas diplomatically and have an official dialogue, because Hamas is a terrorist organization. And this is the position of, again, other civilized countries as well. But there are voices, both in this country and also in Israel, talking about the need to start dealing with Hamas in a kind of a legitimate way and reaching some kind of a working pragmatic agreement with that organization. But our fear is that if this will happen, that we will start a dialogue and basically give legitimacy to that group, the extreme group among the Palestinians, what will happen is basically that we completely give up on the moderate forces and the Palestinians. Because what this will suggest, if we deal with Hamas, is basically that their way won. That their methods, which are basically terrorism, gained for them political victory or political achievements. And that would eradicate completely the moderate side of the Palestinians. And I think that it is very serious and very severe for the future of the peace process. We believe and we hope that the Palestinian people will make their decision between the way of not recognizing, which is Hamas's way, not recognizing in any way Israel's right to exist on any part of the past Palestine, and basically using terrorism to get their goals, and the moderate way that the Fatah is using of finding a compromise, in essence. Now, we don't know exactly how this compromise would look like. We still have differences of opinion, but the notion is of finding a compromise, the need of finding some kind of compromise. Every side will give up some of its dreams and some of its hopes, and we will find some kind of a compromise. And that is something that the Palestinian people will have to decide. Now, the two other scenarios I'm talking about, besides the diplomatic one, is a military scenario, which if these missiles will keep falling and will be a kind of strategic risk to Israel, Israel will have to probably have some kind of military operation to stop them. Now, of course, this is very problematic. Most people in Israel do not want it. The government does not want it. But if in a case of no choice, that might have to be done just to stop these rockets falling on Israeli civilians. And every government has the responsibility for its civil population when missiles fall on their heads. And of course, the human price of this kind of an operation would be enormous. And nobody knows exactly what the results will be and exactly how effective it will be in immediately stopping these rockets. And another question is, what will happen after you leave? Because the idea is not to be there for the long term. So that's the military scenario. Another scenario is the technical scenario, which many people hope will materialize, even though it probably takes time, and that's just finding some kind of a technical device, basically a defense device, that can intercept incoming missiles, because these missiles are causing a lot of problems. Once you can intercept them or prevent them from hitting population, that kind of takes the edge out of what the extreme Palestinians are in Gaza are trying to do. So I think that pretty much covers the Palestinian side of the Israeli-Palestinian side of what I'm planning to talk about. Going up to the north of Israel, as I mentioned, the two dominant factors there are Syria and Hezbollah, the Shiite terrorist organization in Lebanon. And we just recently had a swap agreement of prisoners, of Lebanese prisoners, for the bodies of the two Israelis who were kidnapped in July 2006, what triggered the war in Lebanon in 2006. And that was a very hard agreement for Israel and Israelis to accept, a very painful agreement, because we did not know until the last minute whether these two soldiers are alive and dead or dead. And only when we saw the coffins and checked the coffins, then we knew that they were dead. And this basically shows you the kind of how the other side, namely the Hezbollah organization, works. And the very basic, the basis of civilized society, even in war, is that you give information about prisoners of war and whether they're alive or dead. And that was not done by Hezbollah. And they basically manipulated this information in front of the Israeli public and the Israeli government without knowing whether we're negotiating for soldiers who are alive or dead. And just imagine the feeling of the families of these soldiers over these 2 years, actually not knowing if their sons are alive or dead. So this was a very difficult agreement, but a necessary agreement, because this is part of what the Israeli government, the commitment of the Israeli government towards young Israelis who go into the military and their families. And military service in Israel, as you probably know, is compulsory. All men and women need to serve either 2 years for women or 3 years for men. So this is a very basic issue in Israeli society. Generally talking about Hezbollah, its position in Lebanon, of course, from certain perspectives, has strengthened, and probably from the military perspective. But I think it's not always mentioned, especially in the media, that from other perspectives, there's a lot of criticism on Hezbollah, and I think Hezbollah and its head, Nasrallah, are a little worried on some issues that they're criticized in Lebanon. Because even though they're considered a strong militia, and the strongest militia by far in Lebanon, on the other hand, their claim of using weapons and keeping their militia was they're using it supposedly against Israel and defending Lebanon against Israel. But for the first time, 3 months ago or 2 months ago in May, they started using their weapons against their brothers in Lebanon, against Sunnis and against Christians. If you remember, quite a few people got killed in these clashes. And that causes a great reaction against Hezbollah in, the non-Shiite sects of Lebanon, but also even inside the Shiite sects, because people are really concerned about Hezbollah taking over and the start of a new civil war in Lebanon. And one thing I think is pretty much clear is that the Sunni, Christian, and Druze population would not live under a iron grip or rule of Hezbollah, of a radical Shiite organization. So they would have to find some kind of a middle road. And this is something that they are very much concerned about. So the position of Hezbollah in Lebanon is completely not clear. There are signs that it's getting stronger, but there are also signs that it's getting weaker politically. If you look at the test of what actually happened in the Israeli-Lebanese border since 2006, it was very, very quiet. So there was much talk about Israel using some of its deterrence after 2006, but if you just view the fact is that Hezbollah did not do any provocation in these 2 years since, and that's a lot less than they did in the years previously. So I think what they understand is that there's some kind of balance of power here, and that if they even start a small provocation, they cannot know what the reaction will be, and that basically contributes to the deterrence of Israel towards Hezbollah. With Syria, we have indirect negotiation track about a year ago with the help of Turkey, and the reason for that is because Syria is today very, very important strategically to Israel. And the reason for that is because Syria is right in the middle between Hezbollah and Iran. And we are hoping that Syria will make a turnaround, probably it will have to be kind of a 180-degree turnaround, and move to the camp of the moderate Arab countries aligned with the West. But what that would entail from them is to, of course, break all their ties with Hezbollah, not allow weapons, which are now flowing freely from Damascus Airport, from Iran through Damascus Airport into Lebanon, and Iranian warriors from the Revolutionary Guard going into Lebanon, to stop that completely, to stop their political support for Hezbollah and stop their ties with Iran. If this will happen, this will be a great change in the Middle East in general and specifically to Israel, and Israel would be willing to compromise greatly to get this kind of a change. The thing is, we're not sure what the chances of this happening are. President Assad has always sat on the fence. He wants Western participation, Western connections, Western economic ties on the one hand, but we're not sure if he wants to break his ties with the bad guys. And that's what we expect of him, and I think, the civilized world is expecting of him as a price of reaching a peace deal between Israel and Syria. And just before I finish, the last and I think most serious threat to Israel is Iran. And Iran is the biggest strategic, threat to Israel, but not only to Israel. I think it's an issue of the whole Western world. And this is a very large country. It's a country that has major industry and scientific capabilities. And today it's a very rich country because of the prices of oil. And the biggest problem is that it is led by a very, very radical, extremist, radical Islamist leadership. And this is the only country in the world that publicly calls for destruction of another country, in this case Israel, which if you look around, you don't see any other country saying anything like that anywhere. And this is the only country that actively and in a high profile supports all the worst terrorist organizations, whether it's Hamas, Islamic Jihad, Hezbollah, etc. And this is a country that tries to get nuclear weapons, and that it's having nuclear weapons will change the whole balance in the Middle East. It will allow Iran to do whatever it wants without any kind of sanctions. And this combination between a very radical extremist Islamic leadership with nuclear weapons and with the support of terrorist organizations, I think this is very important, because nuclear weapons is not only something that Iran can use, but it can get to its proxies, which are terrorist organizations. That is a very big danger, I think, to the whole world. And just imagine what the holding of these weapons, nuclear weapons, in the hands of Iran will do to the price of oil, which is now already close to $150. Imagine what will happen in this kind of scenario. And of course, this frightens very much the moderate Arab states around Iran. That probably concerns them a lot more than Israel concerns them. All this, I think, general situation I covered in the Middle East, I think suggests that we're kind of, there's a shifting paradigm in the Middle East. From a Middle East conflict that was talked about as a conflict between Israel and Arab countries, I think it moves clearly today to a situation of a divide between radicals and moderates in the Middle East. And it doesn't matter if you're an Arab or if this is a Jewish country or whoever you are, whether you're moderate or whether you are an extremist. And if you're extremist, for instance, Syria, which is in that camp, is not a Shiite country. But these are the camps now. It's moderates against extremists. And there's a lot more in common today between countries like Egypt and Jordan and Israel than between countries like Iran and Egypt, even though both of these countries are generally Muslim. So I think this is really important to understand, and the radical side is a real threat on, I think, the Western way of life, basically, and I think this should be a concern of not only Israel, but all peace-loving and democratic and democracy-loving citizens all over the world. So just to sum up, Israel in its 60th year is, as I mentioned, in a, boom in some areas, like the economy, and the Israeli economy is doing very well in science and technology. But we're also in the political sense, in a time of in the crossroads in the Middle East, which become more and more global. If you probably would think about it 20 years ago or 30 years ago, the conflict was more localized. It would be considered between Israel and the Palestinians, or it would be localized in the Middle East. People didn't think that it affects the whole world. Today, I think all of these issues, and especially the issue of this conflict between radicals and moderates, affects the whole world. It affects the price of oil. It affects the world economy. And it affects the security of the whole world. And that's how I see the Middle East in the next few years. And I'm sure for American citizens like you, it'll be a major issue. It's a major issue on the on this presidential elections. What I can hope is that in the next 10 years, when Israel would reach its 70s, we will be in a more stable area in the Middle East, because this is very critical both to our future and to the future of the whole world and to the prosperity of the whole world. So thank you very much, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Our thanks to Consul General David Akoff at the Israeli Consulate of the Pacific Northwest Region. My name is Joe Epstein. I'm a past president of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors, and I will be conducting the audience question and answer portion of the program. As you can see, Consul, we have a number of questions here. And before we start, I do want to make sure that everyone knows that today's program is in association with the Jewish Community Relations Council Middle East Project. I neglected to mention that during the introduction. So why don't we begin where you began, actually, which is about many of the accomplishments, technologically speaking, of this small country of 7 million people, Israel. Here's a question as follows. Israel has great technology and industry, and the surrounding Arab countries could benefit if they allowed Israel to establish manufacturing in their respective countries. Do you think there's any possibility of this happening?
Well, this is actually being done in some areas. I wish it would a lot more. But there is a free trade agreement that involves both Israel. It all involves the U.S., but there are benefits to have manufacturing plants of Israeli products in either Jordan or sometimes Egypt, and it's kind of joint manufacturing parts. Some of the product is manufactured in Israel. It's moved to Jordan. Other parts are manufactured and assembled there, and when it's exported to the U.S., it benefits from from the free trade agreement. So this exists in some products. Some of it is in textile, which is kind of low-tech, and I wish it would happen in more sophisticated products, but it might. But at this point, it happens only with Jordan mostly, a little bit with Egypt, and unfortunately not with other Arab countries, but that remains hopefully for the future.
Of course, world health is such a major issue. Could you talk a little bit about the generic drugs? I know Israel is the largest producer of generic drugs in the world, or one of the largest producers.
Yeah, no, Teva, the Teva company, which is an Israeli company, is the largest manufacturer of generic drugs in the world. And I think that's another example of, you know, some of the achievements. Again, you know, when Israel started only 60 years ago, who would believe that, you know, in 60 years the largest drug company will be Israeli? And this is a great pride and a great boom to Israeli economy. It's basically the largest Israeli company and contributes highly to the Israeli GNP.
Well, a few more questions on Israeli technology, if we may, before we get into issues of the Middle East specifically. Outside of New York City, San Francisco is the major city when it comes to Israel, not only because of its large Jewish community, but because the large Israeli presence right here in Silicon Valley. Could you discuss just a few of the cutting-edge technologies that Israel is known for here in cooperation with companies in the Silicon Valley?
Well, I think the kind of the flagship is really what is designed in Intel. Intel, of course, is the biggest computer processors manufacturer in the world, based right here in Santa Clara. And it's one of its main design centers is in Israel, and it designs all the cutting-edge processors. And so this is really something that makes us very proud. By the way, Intel is also the biggest investor in Israel and foreign employer in Israel. It employs something like 6,000 or 7,000 people and has two state-of-the-art new manufacturing facilities in the south of Israel, in Kiryat Gat. So this is really something Israelis are very proud of, and I think justifiably. So Israel is also very strong in internet-related companies, what's called Web 2.0, and a lot of small companies that start in Israel then open an office here because this is the global center, I guess, of technology and of the internet. And there's a lot of, I think, innovation in Israel that somehow is connected to maybe the environment in Israel, the fact that many people do their military service, which is sometimes in connection with technological education that has to do with computers or something like that, and that allows them later in their civilian career to start their own businesses. And there's a big spirit of entrepreneurship. By the way, I think in the NASDAQ stock market, which is mostly of technology, I think after the U.S. and Canada in total numbers, the third country is Israel, even though it's so much smaller than the U.S. and Canada. So there's definitely a big boom in Israeli technology, and it's all connected to Silicon Valley.
We seldom hear about such achievements that you're discussing that Israel has made. We seldom hear about these kinds of achievements in Arab countries. Are you aware of any that would be worth recognizing at this point?
Well, in Arab countries, I think are not considered Western, Western countries, and their infrastructure of, science and technology is not on the same level. I think one country that is starting to get on that track because it's very rich is Saudi Arabia, and they are starting to invest in big universities and big cities that they built from scratch in Western style. And I don't know yet of achievements, but I would assume that if they invest enough in scientific infrastructure and education, they will have enough people to start having achievements in science and technology. But it's hard for me to remember offhand any of these achievements. And again, I don't represent the Arab countries. You will have to bring an Arab diplomat, and I'm sure he can talk about that much better than I do.
Well, that was a little bit of a loaded question, but thank you for your candid answer. I'd like to remind everyone that you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our speaker today is Consul General David Akov at the Israeli Consulate for the Pacific Northwest region. Well, let's do a major shifting of gears here, if we can, Consul General. Starting off with this one, does Israel's large military-industrial complex and incoming military aid from the United States make Israel more or less safe?
I think it makes Israel more safe. We wish we could be completely pacifistic without any military, without any military research and development, and without any military industry, and without any military support from the U.S. But if you have a very simple glance at the map and you see where we are and the neighborhood we're in and the countries that are around us, I think that suggests that if you want to be naive, you're going to pay dearly for that, and that means we cannot allow ourselves to be naive, and we need to be ready. Now, I would truly wish that all of this hardware would never be used, but I think in this kind of a world, you can't allow yourself to just cut it. And we appreciate very much the support of the U.S. to us. Now, by the way, this support is spent in the U.S. For defense systems that are given to Israel, but the money is spent here and provides jobs here in the U.S. And so that is the kind of support that the U.S. Gives Israel. And I think that's it's a reflection of the very close connections between Israel and the U.S., which has, have very many layers, but that's a different issue.
Consul General Akoff, in your prepared remarks, you did spend a significant amount of time talking about Gaza and the Gaza pullout. This question here wants to know if Israel really went into this with its eyes open, or was there a failure of Israeli intelligence, and is that why so many problems existed?
No, I don't think there was a failure of intelligence. I think everybody knew that there is a risk, but I think most people thought, and I think many still think, that it was worth taking, because I don't think that staying in Gaza would have changed that much, because we can't control the Palestinian population there. Even when we were inside, they still had quite a few shooting of rockets to either the Israeli settlements that were inside and then dismantled, or to Sderot, which is outside of the Gaza Strip. And there was a very high cost of the Israeli defense forces being there, basically, in Gaza and in the center of Palestinian population. So I think still many people think that it was a needed thing to do. And I don't think our staying there would have changed dramatically the direction of Palestinians. So that is part of our dilemma. And that is one of the issues that I mentioned of, you know, whether even if Israel will have to go in again militarily to stop rocket firing, what exactly will that change? Nobody knows.
It's very complex, and there are many components as to why we do not have, at this moment, a two-state solution or a peace treaty with the Palestinian people. One of them is the right of return, and I'd like to make that part B of this question. And I know we can really spend a lot of time with that, but if you can condense that issue, that would be appreciated. The other issue is a very hot one, which is the division of Jerusalem, east and west. Will Israel ever agree to divide Jerusalem as part of the peace process with the Palestinians?
Well, in terms of what is called the right of return by the Palestinians, this is an issue that, from Israel's point of view, is a non-starter, because what it basically says is that all Palestinian refugees that are today in the millions, probably 4 million or so, will automatically be let in to Israel proper. Now, this goes against the whole notion of the two-state solution, because our logic, and I think everybody who deals with it, it should be their logic, is that if we're going into a historic compromise of two states, I mean, taking this area that used to be Palestine and dividing it into a a Jewish state, Israel, and a Palestinian state, which would probably be called Palestine, the issue is that the relative refugees will go to the respective countries. Now, most people do not remember that many Jewish refugees, they were refugees then, after 1948, left Arab countries, like Iraq or like Libya or Egypt, and moved into Israel. And they became Israeli citizens, and they were not called anymore refugees. While Palestinian refugees stayed, of course, refugees, and the whole idea is that with the historic compromise, these refugees, if they will want to return, will return to the Palestinian part, which would be a Palestinian state. So this is the way, I think, the logical way of seeing it. And any other way of saying, well, you know, we'll reach an historic compromise, we'll have two states, but every Palestinian who left what is now Israel will have the right to go back to Israel. This is completely a non-starter. It's against the whole logic of this historic compromise. Yes, and the second,
Jerusalem, splitting Jerusalem in two.
The Israeli position is that Jerusalem is unified. And this is the position. Now, there are areas outside of Jerusalem, outside of the municipal area of Jerusalem, that could be considered also Jerusalem. And I think some of the ideas are that in a future agreement, these areas were outside of the municipal, of the official municipal area, could serve as a place of governance and symbolic governance of the Palestinians, and could be considered Jerusalem. One of the ideas was Abu Dis, for instance, where there's actually a Palestinian parliament that's been built. But our position is that Jerusalem would stay unified.
So here's a question that I think is another hot-button issue. You state that the Israelis are interested in peace with the Palestinians and in a two-state solution, yet Israel continues to build the security wall and expand its settlements. The policy and the reality appear to be in conflict.
I don't think so. I think when I said that terrorism was the main issue that endangers the peace process, I meant the fact that 3 or 4 years ago, or maybe even more, 6 years ago, a Palestinian terrorist could just walk half an hour from the West Bank to an Israeli town and board a bus and explode himself with 40 people, innocent civilians. One of the things we wanted to do is just stop this immediately, and that was in complete consensus in Israel. And that's why this fence, which is a temporary fence, was being built just to stop terrorism. Now, by the way, this fence hasn't been built before the second intifada started in this terrible wave of suicide bombings. So this is not some kind of way of that Israel wanted to achieve some kind of political goal. It was a direct reaction to the terrible situation of suicide bombers just walking and boarding buses or entering malls without any kind of obstacle. So fortunately, this fence, which doesn't look good, it's an ugly fence, I agree with that, and most people would agree, it just saves lives. And it's true that it, even if it creates sometimes inconveniences, that's true, the bottom line is that it saved probably hundreds, if not thousands, of lives. Now, as I said, this is a temporary fence. It is not a political border. And the idea is that once we have an agreement with the Palestinians of where the border between the two states will go, this fence will be dismantled, and it can be dismantled fairly fast. In the northern part of Israel in the year 2000, when Israel left parts of Lebanon, this kind of fence that existed there was dismantled in a matter of days. So this is really, it's not a political issue. At this point, it's a security barrier that does its work.
Well, wars have been started and fought over water. In Israel, the Kinneret is the main water supply of the state of Israel. Does the Kinneret also supply the Palestinian areas?
The Kinneret is part of the Israel's water supply, and some of Israel's water supply goes also to some Palestinian areas, but most of the Palestinian areas have their own wells. But again, I wouldn't like to go more into details because I'm not an expert on water issue. This is a very professional issue.
Council General Ackoff, you yourself in some previous meetings in your recent career have talked about the need for moderation of Palestinian leadership. So now the Fatah faction has Mahmoud Abbas as its leader. Do you think that this has made a material difference on the ongoing relationship between the Palestinians and Israel?
Definitely. I think today, as opposed to the times of Yasser Arafat, for instance, that his relations with the Israeli leadership, whoever they may be, I mean, from different parties, whether it was Rabin or Peres or Netanyahu or Barak or Sharon, had a very, very problematic relations, while Mahmoud Abbas, I think, has a much, much better relation with, again, different Israeli leaders. The problem, we think that Mahmoud Abbas represents the moderate side, and we believe that his aims are true. The issue is, how can he deliver? And whether he as a leader can control these territories and lead and be an effective leader in a way that can move us forward to an agreement.
Let's talk about the shifting in relationships in the Middle East currently. There appears to be a subtle shift and hints of a new approach in the Middle East peace talks. Hamas, Hezbollah, Syria, Iran, and Israel have come a little closer together. Do you think that the presumptive Democratic candidate, Senator Barack Obama's comments about his willingness to talk with our enemies if he were elected president has had something to do with this? And what do you think of his current trip through the Middle East?
Well, I think there are a few questions inside this. You know, the specific agreement signed, I think you have to divide them again. With Syria, you can call it some kind of a resumption of peace talks, because we're talking about two countries that had peace talks in the past, and we're resuming that, and we're doing that in a full-fledged diplomatic way with the good offices of the Turkish government. With the organizations, which, as I said, are still terrorist organizations, both Hamas and Hezbollah, What these specific agreements were agreements of necessity, both, you know, to exchange bodies or POWs. This is something that you have to do even with an organization that is completely illegitimate or a terrorist organization, because you have this commitment to your soldiers and to the families of the soldiers. And the same thing goes with Hamas, by the way, that holds another Israeli soldier who is alive. We know he's alive because we had signs of life from him. And also to reach some kind of an agreement, at least to cease fire. But I wouldn't call this peace negotiations, not because of a lack. I mean, of course, we see it as a terrorist organization, but the problem is this terrorist organization completely doesn't recognize Israel's legitimacy, right to exist. So, you know, what can you talk about with this kind of an organization? How can you talk to an organization that completely negates your existence? So I don't think you can call this agreement, you know, any kind of movement towards towards peace negotiations. We can have peace negotiations with Mahmoud Abbas, who, as I said, represents the kind of the compromise philosophy and the moderate philosophy in the Palestinian side. You can talk about peace negotiation with an organization that its credo is that there's no place for Israel anywhere between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean, and basically that Jews in Israel should pack their bags and go back to Poland, Egypt, Iraq, or Morocco. That's basically what they think. So I think you have to divide between that. Now, the second question, I think, was about
Senator Obama's
trip. You know, I think presidential candidates, especially in this day and age, the Middle East is a very important place for them. Now, Senator McCain was there before. Maybe the coverage was not the same because it was also earlier in the cycle. And as a presidential candidate, I think it's very important. I think it sends a message to the Middle East. I think the whole world watches also Senator Obama, and I think they watched also Senator McCain, because it's important to see what the views are. And of course, even though most of the world cannot vote here, they're definitely interested in what will happen and what the outcome will be. I generally think it's positive, both because it's good for the candidates to learn more about this area, to hear directly from those who are there, and I think it's also a symbol for the area that the United States is interested and will be engaged. And I think that's a very positive sign.
Well, unfortunately, we've reached the point in the program where there's time for just one last question, and I'm going to try to cheat a little bit and get two in if I can. Mm-hmm. So, first question, is there any one Arab country whose support of a peace process and recognition of Israel could really turn the tide in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict?
Well, it did happen with Egypt, which is a very important country, even though it didn't convince immediately other Arab countries to do it, but it was a huge strategic change. Looking into the future, I would say Saudi Arabia would be very, very important. Very important because of its sheer size, its power, because of its wealth. And unfortunately, they've been more or less sitting on the fence in many times. But I think if they will move forward into having relations with Israel, recognizing Israel, having some kind of more substantial dialogue with Israel, this will be a great sign to the rest of at least the moderate Arab world. So, I would say Saudi Arabia if I had to choose one country. Yes.
So if I can squeeze in this last question, please. The questioner doesn't state it, but this may be about Hamas. It does say, how long does a terrorist organization have to lay down its arms before it is defined as a legitimate defender of its people and therefore a partner for peace?
I don't know. It's a tough question. As we say, you know, if Hamas will not deal with terrorism, it will not be a terrorist organization, and then it will be different. In order to negotiate with them, we will also have them to stop negating Israel in all ways. But you know, if an organization does not deal with terrorism after a while, but I can't say exactly how long, maybe it will not be called a terrorist organization. But I want to stress that this is not the case with Hamas, because Hamas even recently sent suicide bombers to do all kinds of terrorist acts, and also sent, for instance, the drivers of the tractor in Jerusalem who killed people through using the bulldozer, which is also a kind of terrorism. I mean, if you're attacking a bus of innocent people with a bulldozer, that's an act of terrorism. So, you know, if they give specific endorsement and send people to do that, I think that's a terrorist organization.
Well, I would like to thank our audience for all of the wonderful, wonderful questions, and special thanks to Consul General David Akoff at the Israeli Consulate for the Pacific Northwest Region. We thank our audiences here and on the radio. I'm Joe Epstein, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion is adjourned.